Senator Edmund Muskie, speaking at a fundraising rally for the Reverend Joseph Duffy, January 31, 1971, the University of Hartford.
Senator Muskie was winning the very deep respect and the admiration of millions of Americans. What was it that made this man stand out and captured the imagination of so many Americans in 68? It was that in a time of great pretension and double talk, he carried himself very quietly. That in the rough and tumble of the political world, he survived intact. When other people shouted and said nothing, he spoke quietly and firmly, and people listened. He was, I think, the only figure who stood out on either side when the dust of November 1968 had cleared. But there was one event alone that captured the real imagination of the American people. It was, I think, in Pennsylvania in the course of that campaign that Senator Muskie was jeered by a noisy heckler in the crowd. He quietly invited the young man to come to the stage, and then he listened to him, and then he responded to him. And we were perhaps struck more than anything else by a politician who listened. Last May, when students were murdered at Jackson State while many Americans were still reeling from the events of Cambodia and Kent State, Senator Muskie quietly, without any fanfare, chartered a plane and took a group from Washington to Mississippi to express his grief and his concern. He is a quiet man who, when he came to Connecticut, did what he did on the night before the election, untangled the messy, bitter issues in a difficult contest and laid them bare, and spoke very clearly about issues which had been covered with a layer of bitterness and campaign rhetoric. And again, he won the admiration of millions of our citizens. And in December, when the administration used a Sante feudal raid on a prisoner of war camp to cover up the bombing of the North, he spoke first and more forcibly than any other critic of the administration. He has, I believe, earned a place of leadership in the Democratic Party and in the country. And I am proud that he has come back to Connecticut to help us not simply to clear up the debts of the past, but to help us look toward the work of the future. And I am pleased to present to you Senator Ed Muskie.
Travel some 25,000 miles with me the past month on various journeys, my wife Jane. I appreciate that generous introduction, Joe, but in all honesty, it reminds me of something Haywood Bruin once said when he was introduced with great generosity. He said he knew what a pancake felt after syrup had been poured on it. But I'm grateful for it. I'm delighted to be here in Connecticut, in part because it is an old stamping ground of mine, going back years before I entered politics. I've had the opportunity in the last 15 years to visit Connecticut on one political mission or another, beginning with Abe Ribicoff's campaign for governor in 1954. And then last fall, it was my privilege to be here with Joe, as he has said. I regret that he did not win. But as he was so kind as to describe my campaign in 1968, sometimes in losing you win, although I've never really been satisfied that it's the same thing. Unless maybe losing the vice presidency is a way of winning. Especially when one reads the current job specification for the vice presidency. I ought at this point to say how delighted I am that you had some winners in Connecticut last November. Bob Killian, Attorney General, and that very attractive Gloria Schaefer for Secretary of State. And Bill Carter for Congress. And this afternoon I had the privilege of meeting with some of your new young legislative leaders. And I can see new leadership emerging in Connecticut to take the places of those of the past. And so to be the bridge from the past to the future isn't a bad posture to have, Joe, especially by your side here this afternoon. I came here from Maine, a place to which I retreat increasingly rarely these days, but a place where I can still get perspective and refreshment. I couldn't help but be reminded of the story as I flew down from Maine, the story of the man from Connecticut who was summering in Maine. And he stopped at a farmhouse along the road to get his bearings, thought he might have lost his way. And the farmer pointed out that this was the only farmhouse either way for 6 miles. The man from Connecticut said, well, it's a beautiful place, but isn't it a little lonely up here? Lonely, mister? Why, he said, on a clear day you can see Mount Washington in New Hampshire. I'll let you think about that one. It has relevance to our times, to the issues which divide us, to the climate of frustration and controversy and ferment which set us against each other. Confuse us as to each other's intentions and as to our nation's goals. All of these things were much clearer in an environment when to see Mount Washington was to be neighborly. And this all has something to do with Joe Duffy's campaign in Connecticut in 1970. I've said that Joe Duffy won in 1970. Not in terms of a seat in the United States Senate, but in terms of what he wanted to prove. He wanted to prove that the political process can and ought to be of the people. He wanted to prove that people of different backgrounds and lifestyles and attitudes can be persuaded in a sensible way. He wanted to prove that politics is not only compromise, it is also conviction. And for Joe to come as close as he did to being elected, with all the obstacles he faced, was a tribute to the courage of that conviction. He refused to be intimidated by the politics of distortion and malicious abuse. And for that alone, we owe him our gratitude. He campaigned in the belief that change in America is possible. He believed that change is possible if enough of us have the courage to join in a coalition for change. And he worked for a coalition based not on age or income or ideology, but on a shared sense of purpose and direction and hope. And I believe he was right. And I believe he was right about the need for a new coalition in America. In the last 2 years, I have traveled to 45 states, and I've listened to Americans of every description. Beyond all the special grievances, and there are some, and the local problems, and they are many, I found a deep concern that we seem to have lost control over our lives, that we seem to be drifting aimlessly, that individuals no longer seem to count, and that the institutions we created to serve us have somehow managed to master us. And still worse is that more and more people have begun to assume that there is nothing they or anyone else can do about it. For too many Americans, there is a temptation to retreat. Behind the walls of hostility and suspicion and fear, the walls which divide them from their neighbors, the walls which keep them from what they might otherwise become. Joe Duffy was one man who said no to that temptation, and he was right. And people began to listen to him in 1970 and to understand that there is another road to travel. And that road is the road of trust and common purpose, traveled by a coalition for change. It is not an easy road or a shortcut, but it does offer the possibility of changing what must be changed. Our national priorities, our economic policies, our policy in Southeast Asia. There is no lasting peace in the policy of Vietnamization, and there is no prospect in that policy for an end to the suffering of the Vietnamese people. It is right, of course, to withdraw our combat forces from South Vietnam, as we are doing, but it is wrong to increase the level of our military activities in Cambodia and over the skies of North Vietnam. Is this the plan we were promised in 1968? We were told by this administration last June that it would fly no combat support missions inside Cambodia. What are we to believe in January when the Secretary of Defense dismisses this pledge as mere semantics? We have tried in the Congress to limit America's involvement in Cambodia. And if the letter of the Cooper Church Amendment is not clear enough to preserve that limit, then I believe we must make it clear. I believe we must limit our military presence, not only in Cambodia, but also in Laos and in Vietnam. And I believe we must commit ourselves firmly to the complete withdrawal of our forces from Indochina by a fixed and definite date. And this much is certain, the only light at the end of the tunnel will be the one we strike ourselves. And if this administration does not have the courage to strike that light, then a new coalition will. This administration has not hesitated to use the transition to a peacetime economy as a scapegoat for unemployment. It is time for it to stop passing the buck. For 2 long years, they have told us about the game plan they had for the economy. And what has that game plan really been, except a deliberate policy of tight money? And what have been the results of that policy, except more inflation, less production, and fewer jobs in every segment of our economy? And a president's State of the Union message, which turns 180 degrees on his own economic policy, doesn't change those facts. And the fault does not lie in the transition to a peacetime economy, which incidentally we have yet to see, but in a game plan which failed to strengthen our civilian economy and which failed to keep precious manpower and machines from being wasted in idleness. And how little this administration seems to care about the effects of that plan. It said no to a program of public service jobs last year, but it says yes in January of this year to a depreciation tax break for business at more than 10 times the cost. It is time for this administration to understand that unemployment means more than percentage points and monthly statistics. It means men and women deprived of the dignity of work. I believe that every American, willing and able to work, must have the right to a job opportunity. And if this administration does not work to establish that right, then a new coalition will. The president was not far from the truth in his State of the Union address when he said, Americans are fed up with government. That should be no surprise to this administration. This is the administration which warned us about a health care crisis and vetoed a bill to train family doctors. This is the administration which talked about limiting campaign spending and vetoed a bill to control most of the costs. This is the administration which promised to bring us together and tried in the 1970 campaign to drive us apart. And what are we to say in January of 1971, when we hear that same administration say that it has finally decided to alter its course? We can say, and truthfully, that we hope the administration will change its strategy. We hope the next 2 years are different from the last. We hope the administration can do better because we want the country to do better. But if this administration fails to revise our national priorities, that a new coalition will. And may I say that I don't really believe that we can expect that kind of a change from an administration which proposes such a change only because it sees that it needs a different political game plan to win the elections in 1972. That simply is not good enough. We need a coalition which cares about the problems of housing and of schools and of transportation. We need a coalition which is for a meaningful program of national health insurance. We need a coalition which is for a vigorous enforcement of consumer protection laws across the board. We need a coalition which is for an effective policy to make key wage and price decisions which will serve the public good. That kind of coalition can still do what John Kennedy asked of us 10 years ago when he said, "With a good conscience, our only sure reward, let us go forth to lead the land we love." And we must regain that spirit in America. And we must regain it in Connecticut. With the help of Joe Duffy and Mem Dodaro and the whole Democratic Party. And we must regain it together. You have united in the past behind John Dempsey, behind Abe Rivercock, behind John Kennedy. And you must unite behind values. Values that we share in common. Values that cut across every racial and geographic and economic line. Values of peace and opportunity and freedom. We all want the war to end, and we will end it. We all want the right to grow in a healthy and peaceful environment. We all want the right to be employed in a decent job. And we all want the right to be safe wherever we live in America. And we all want the right to be free from the invasion of privacy by the government or anyone else. And we will make these rights ours. For almost 200 years, we have taught our children about the promise of America, about what this land has yet to be. And if we would listen, we would know that our children have been trying to tell us not to forget these very same lessons. There is no place in America for divisiveness or hypocrisy or false accusation. That is what men like Joe Duffy told the American people in 1970, and the people began to respond. We can and we must build in the weeks and months ahead. In a way that J.B. Priestley once explained in these words, "There's one here, one there, until you begin to see there are millions of us. Yes, armies and armies of us. Enough to build 10,000 new cities where men and women don't work for machines and money, but machines and money work for men and women, where want and disease and fear have vanished forever, where men have at last stopped mumbling and gnawing and scratching in the dark caves and have come out into the sunlight. And nobody can ever darken it for them again. They're out at last. But that may be an ideal. And it may be an ideal difficult to reach. But it is the ideal, not always clearly seen or heard or articulated, which is motivating all of the restlessness which circles this globe. I visited what is called the cradle of civilization in January, circling what was the Roman world, visiting the ancient places of Israel and Egypt and Moscow and Germany. And I talked with the leaders, but what I sensed in these four places, which generate some of the most explosive issues of our time, is the restlessness of the dreams which are moving people to seek better lives. If governments articulate policies which threaten war, it's because they feel the pressures from their people. If government articulate positions which seem intransigent, it's because they feel the pressures of their people. If governments change their policies in ways that are incomprehensible to us, it is because they feel the pressures of their people. If we seek the pressures which can move mankind to the uplands of peace and justice, we must find it in the people of this planet. They do not want war. They do not want misery. They do not want fear. They do not want hatred and suspicion and distrust. They do not yet have it within their power to eliminate the conditions which breed such hatred and such instability and such unrest. But they have ways of bringing pressures upon their governments and their country's policies. And what the leaders, the enlightened leaders of this planet, must somehow identify are the policies and the goals and the ideals which can mobilize the teeming masses of humanity behind the policies of wisdom and restraint and enlightened choice and understanding and compassion. Impossible? Well, when one looks at the fact that Jesus and Mohammed and the other great religious leaders have not yet persuaded man to commit himself to such ideals, then perhaps political leaders presume too much when they accept the burden of the same responsibility. But it is the same responsibility. And if we do achieve this kind of life, which is the only kind that holds the potential of livability for the earth, then not only God's spokesmen, but man's leaders must aspire to the same ideals and objectives. And it may be that in this year, 1971, we finally see mankind moving to the ultimate crunch when he either chooses that path or the path of total destruction and annihilation. It may be that our human fallibilities and weaknesses and shortcomings are too great for us to reach this far. But to reach for it is the most exhilarating experience that can come to a society to its leaders, to its government. It's this kind of response to the restless urgings of deprived and hungry people, and that includes most of God's children, that can revitalize and reinvigorate the purposes of organized institutions on this planet. That's the nature of our challenge. It's not often well articulated, and it gets lost in the grubby nuts and bolts of government organization, revenue sharing plans, reforms of the federal structure, and these are all essential chores. But as we apply ourselves to them, let's not lose sight of the ultimate purpose of it all, and that is to make life better for God's children on this planet. There is no other challenge. There is no other job. Unless we have some sense of the sacredness and the enormity that challenge and are willing to gird ourselves for it, we will not meet it, and we will have lost everything. But in striving for it, we can achieve something that we've achieved so many times. In this blessed land of America, and that is an awareness from time to time that we've made more progress toward it than man has ever seen before, and that the progress we have made in the past is the promise that we can do more in the future. And that is the task to which I would like to apply myself and intend to for as long as I'm given any political responsibility whatsoever. And it's because I could see Joe Duffy responding to this challenge that I was privileged to come here last fall and again tonight to speak to you good people of Connecticut and to my friends of this nutmeg state. Thank you. Good night. God bless you all.